This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Alan Scott. Now, I know I've said this before, and I'm sure I'll say it a million times more, but just in case you missed it, Bloomberg Government is the only information service provider in Washington that focuses on the business impact of government actions. That's what we do, day in, day out, every day. Take a look at bgov.com. That's bgov.com. And to sweeten the pot, we've actually partnered with Federal News Radio here at 1500 AM, bringing that concept to the airwaves every Thursday at 11 AM and Fridays at 2:30. You want more? It's real simple. www.bgov.com. That's Bravo George Oscar Victor, for those of you playing along at home. Now, earlier this week, President signed a proclamation reaffirming the essential role exports play in creating jobs and improving the U.S. economy. That proclamation declared that this week be World Trade Week. I can hear the cheers now. Well, in celebration, we've decided to bring the world of trade into focus right here on Capital Impact. We're going to speak to Melissa Avstray, who is a legislative analyst with Bloomberg Government. She's going to discuss something known as a miscellaneous tariff bill, or MTB, along with earmarks and how they impact the world of free trade. You know, U.S. companies have a lot at stake here, making goods cost-effective or cost-prohibitive depending on the tariff. She'll help us understand the good, the bad, and, of course, the ugly. With the House on recess and Senate out next week, congressional analyst Lauren Duggan has his eye towards the month of June on the Hill. Student loan rates could double if the House and Senate can't come to an agreement. The highway bill is on deck. Where do we stand with appropriations? What in the world is going on the Hill? Lauren will be here in a little while to discuss that. But we kick off World Trade Week here with a look at a couple of Bloomberg Government studies written by my guests here in studio. First one entitled, U.S. Trade Remedies May Harm U.S. Companies. And part two, Duties on Chinese Solar Panels May Harm U.S. Companies. Subtitled, The Indirect Impact of Unfair Trade Cases. The authors are here. Please welcome Caitlin Weber, a trade analyst with Bloomberg Government, along with Ken Monahan, economic analyst with Bloomberg Government. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Helen.
Thank you both for coming in. So the president has made no bones about the fact that he wants a lot of our energy, up to 80% of it, to come from clean energy sources. One of these sources could be solar power. A lot of those things are coming from China at this point. We're talking about the elements, the rare materials that are being pulled out of the earth over there. But according to the president, he says, you know, if China would simply let the market work on its own, we'd have no objections. He added, but their policies currently are preventing that from happening, and they go against the very rules that China agreed to follow with regard to trade. So, Ken, I turn to you. I know the Commerce Department met on May 17th. What was the outcome?
The outcome was that Commerce announced they would impose duties of at least 31% on U.S. imports of solar panels. These are the panels that generate solar electricity on your home or anywhere essentially which generates that electricity, puts it into the electric grid, you name it. And so the duties will be on Chinese products exported from China into the U.S., 31% for most of these exporters, but also as much as 250% for certain exporters of solar panels from China.
They've kind of got a lock on this at this point, don't they?
They've done real well in terms of being able to provide source to the U.S. market. There are U.S. companies.
Sure.
But essentially, the Chinese have been very competitive in this market. The prices for Chinese panels are about 13% below the price for these panels elsewhere in the world. So there really is a price competitiveness that they've been able to really get at with their exports to the U.S.
Caitlin, at what point would you say this is going to, the tariffs and such, are they going to directly impact the ability for us to fulfill the president's wishes?
So the tariffs that were imposed last week were pretty high. If you think about the tariffs that are normally on imports of solar panels, they're either duty-free or they're 2 or 3%. And as Ken said, the extra tariffs that were imposed under this case, which is an anti-dumping case, those are going to range up to 200% of an imported solar panel's value. Most of the larger solar panel imports will be around 30%. Mm-hmm. So But still, compared to what they are now, duty-free or 2 or 3%, that's a big jump. So that's really going to change how competitive Chinese imports are in the U.S. And where we think we're going to see the biggest impact on this, apart from U.S. solar panel makers, and this was the focus of the studies that Ken and I did for Bloomberg Government last week, was companies that import these solar panels in order to develop solar energy systems for homes and businesses. They relied on Chinese imports because they're lower costs.
Right.
So the higher cost on these panels is going to make those imports obviously more expensive, and it could increase the price for solar energy in the U.S. That's what some of the companies that are against these duties are saying. It could make solar energy less competitive, and the industry is already struggling.
You brought up something, a term. Anti-dumping. And I know you mentioned that anti-dumping and countervailing throughout both of the studies. Ken, could you take a moment just to define the two of those, just in case there are those that may not be up to speed?
Right. So an anti-dumping duty is essentially designed to counteract a good that's sold below market value.
Mm-hmm.
What that means, it's below the price that, you know, a free market should prevail for that price.
Sure.
On countervailing duties, it's similar in the sense that it's going against what's perceived to be an illegal or kind of a regular activity. So China will be subsidizing, or any government will be subsidizing, the exporter, you know, products that are exported into the United States, and therefore getting a benefit. The countervailing duties are designed to counteract that benefit that companies in China are able to attain from that subsidy.
So we kind of joked a minute ago, hey, China's really got a lock on this. They've really done a pretty good job at this. What other types, or would you call this a retaliation of sorts, Caitlin, or how would this be classified?
So the U.S. industry that brought this case would definitely not want it to be called retaliation or protectionism.
Okay.
They would not like those terms. They would say they're just trying to correct unfair trade. They're just trying to make things fair, not to gain any advantage. But you brought up the term retaliation, and one of the potential impacts that we could see after these duties go into effect, and we've seen this in the past, where a foreign government will initiate an anti-dumping case against U.S. exports into that country. And we saw that back in 2009 when the U.S. imposed high tariffs and imports of Chinese tires into the U.S. China, a couple of weeks later, started a case that eventually led to tariffs on imports into China mm-hmm. from the U.S. of chicken. And chicken, China had been the largest export market for poultry exporters at that time. So that's a potential impact here as well. We've already heard some in the Chinese solar industry asking the Chinese Ministry of Commerce to potentially pursue a case in China against certain exports of solar equipment from the U.S.
So this is, I mean, you just mentioned chickens and various, this is more than just, I realize the studies, by the way, this is Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact. I'm Alan Scott. We're sitting here talking to Caitlin Weber and Ken Monahan, a couple of analysts with Bloomberg Government, high-level analysts with Bloomberg Government, I might add, who've written a couple of studies. U.S. trade remedies may harm U.S. companies, and duties on Chinese solar panels may harm U.S. companies, with a subtitle, The Indirect Impact of Unfair Trade Cases, which the president admittedly doesn't jump into these anti-dumping cases flippantly, but this is one that he's kind of taken to heart. He's kind of put it in his pocket and said, we're going to fix this. Is that fair to say, Ken?
Well, I think that there is a process for any of these anti-dumping and countervailing duty cases where, you know, the administration, the government goes through it. You know, it's a
I should say the administration, not
sure,
the president.
No. Yeah. Sure, but I think that, right. No, but the thing is that for each of these, there's a process. And so it's you know, to some degree, not apolitical, but there is that process mm-hmm. that goes into play. However, given the importance of the Obama administration of renewable energy and solar, this one has a little bit of an extra attention
right.
and focus, if you will. And so there's certainly more people looking at it and certainly at the overall impact that this will have on the industry.
Yeah, and we should also say that the Obama administration has said that they are taking trade enforcement really seriously, and anti-dumping and countervailing mm-hmm. duties are one of the most common measures applied under U.S. trade remedies, U.S. trade enforcement strategy. So Obama said in his State of the Union speech that they've brought cases against China at twice the rate of the Bush administration. This is something that they're saying they're taking really seriously. Anyone that's not playing fair on trade, they're going to go after.
Right. And that's a good thing. I mean, for all parties involved, not just, well, we're going to level balance what's happening overseas and bring it into the States, thus making everybody happy, so to speak. But this is more than just solar panels. We're talking about a lot of different things here, rare materials. There's an incredible picture within the study itself that Dave Merrill did, which details the pieces of a Boeing 747-8 series, I guess it is. These pieces are coming worldwide. This is a global issue, not just something that the U.S. is dealing with. These parts are coming from everywhere.
Well, that graphic is showing kind of how a supply chain works kind of globally in the sense of, you know, any industry is the world's a closer and closer place. And so I think within the solar panel industry, you see, you know, inputs, polysilicon, which goes into it's the core, the critical input that goes into solar cells and panels. In many cases, that's being exported by the U.S. to China. And then, you know, Chinese, be they from the U.S. or from China or other sources of polysilicon, are using polysilicon to then ship panels to the U.S. And then, you know, that's being installed by solar installers. And so the point, part of the point of our studies is showing and illustrating how integrated global trade really is and how important it is for sourcing that different companies get products from different places. If the Chinese are selling below market fair value price on something or subsidies are happening, that can disrupt, you know, a fair market. I think that's something that we're looking at here and trying to focus on.
Yeah, and I think the picture is a little – it's complicated because of the global supply chains. Mm-hmm. So there's not just a winner and a loser here. What we talk about in our study is that it's so much bigger than just the U.S. solar panel makers who are saying they can't compete. It's the importers who rely on low-cost imports of the solar panels, and it's – the polysilicon exporters, who are an export-dependent industry, who sent over $700 million of this product to China last year. So it's a lot larger than I think the parties that most people look at when they think about these cases. There's not clear winners and losers here, and that's what we tried to show in our study.
That was what my next question was. Who are the winners and losers here? And you just answered it. Not quite clear winners and losers in this one. Caitlin, any parting thoughts that you'd like to make sure people get out of the studies?
So I guess we just want people, we hope that people take from the studies that the picture here is more complicated than just the petitioner and the respondent. U.S. companies and U.S. companies outside of the solar supply chain depend on imports, and Melissa will talk about this later, how important imports are into their manufacturing and retail processes. So whenever there's a restriction on those, there's going to be an impact, and the impacts can, you know, differ depending on the level of duties, but that's something that we should look at as well.
Ken, any parting words?
Well, I think one of the things we touched on earlier was talking about, you know, chickens and other products that can be affected by these cases. And, you know, if China retaliates against the U.S. Mm-hmm. on solar panels, it may not be on polysilicon. We talked about that as being one way China may do so.
Sure.
But there were tires that the U.S. had slapped tariffs on, Chinese tires. And then China turned around and slapped tariffs on chickens. So I think one of the things we're all kind of watching and have no idea where this will go is how China will respond. And if they'll respond on any other industry or important U.S. export, I won't even sit here and speculate what they could be, but they could try to hit at a really politically important sector, which has nothing to do ostensibly with solar. So one of the things we'll be watching at Bloomberg government going forward is just how will China respond and what way will they respond and what kinds of companies will be affected by that.
Ken Monahan, Caitlin Weber, a couple of incredible analysts with Bloomberg Government. The studies are entitled U.S. Trade Remedies May Harm U.S. Companies or Duties on Chinese Solar Panels May Harm U.S. Companies, The Indirect Impact of Unfair Trade Cases. Will you come back and keep us up to date when they zig? How are we going to zag?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. This is Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. So in studio now with us is a couple of people who know an awful lot about stuff on the Hill. Legislation, congressional stuff. A congressional analyst by the name of Lauren Duggan is here with me. Hello, Lauren.
Thanks for having me again, Alan.
Anytime. You're like an old pro at this now. And we've got someone new to the program. She's a legislative analyst. She's a legislative analyst wearing a pink sweater like today. No, actually, very, very intelligent woman who's actually written a Big of Insight. Tariff reductions caught up in earmark ban, and that's kind of where we're going with this conversation. Melissa Abstract. Did I get it right?
You did.
Woo-hoo!
Good job.
All right. Melissa's here with us. Thank you very much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
I appreciate
Thank you
it.
For having me.
So, Melissa, you wrote this this Big of Insight. Incredible insight. A lot to say in just a couple of words, which can be found on bgov.com, by the way, bgov.com. Let's back up. Before we get into the earmarks, let's talk a little bit about the legislation around the earmark. Now, we're talking about the MT MTB?
Yes, the Miscellaneous Tariff Bill.
Tell me about the Miscellaneous Tariff Bill. Give us some background, some history, where we're going with this, and how this is important.
Sure, happy to. So this is a piece of legislation that Congress passes every few years, and it essentially compiles numerous tariff proposals introduced by members of the House and members of the Senate into one omnibus piece of legislation.
Mm-hmm.
And the last bill that Congress passed was in August of 2010, and that reduced tariff rates on over 600 products, and that benefited about a little over 100 companies.
Mm-hmm.
And those tariff rates expire at the end of this year. So that is why the topic is once again coming up on Capitol Hill, because Congress needs to do something to address those rates, or the cost to import 600 products is going to go up.
My question was just, you just answered it. I was going to say, we're looking at companies outside of the U.S. at this point, correct? For the most part. Companies reside in the U.S. but are looking to import products.
That's
okay.
Correct.
Okay. A little while ago, we were just talking to Ken and Caitlin,
mm-hmm.
looking at percentages upwards of 31% with regard to solar panels.
Mm-hmm.
Could we be looking at percentages that high towards the end of this year with regard to tariff?
There's a cap on the amount of revenue that the U.S. government will lose
mm-hmm.
with the tariff suspension. So the highest amount that the government will lose is around $500,000 per product. But again, these are 600
right.
products, so it is a significant amount of revenue to the federal government that we're talking about here.
Lauren, how difficult is this decision on the Hill to come to? Last time this came up, obviously 2010, as Melissa stated. Where are they in this discussion at this point?
Well, they're to the stage where members have introduced the individual bills, because they start with each member has one bill covering one product. So
mm-hmm.
members can introduce multiple ones if there's multiple companies that need that. So at this point, they're doing the reviewing of the individual bills that have been introduced. And most of the time in previous years, it was a bill that came together fairly smoothly because lots of members got something out of it, and they packaged it together with other smaller trade provisions. So it was almost a routine piece of legislation in the past that every couple of years they got to it and they passed it once everybody had come to an agreement.
So coming to an agreement is like, okay, I've got these companies in my district that are looking, is that what we're talking about here? I've got a bunch of companies that are under my jurisdiction and I want to make sure they are taken care of, and we all kind of roll them up into one big piece of legislation
right.
and, yes. And pass it.
And it's been sold as a jobs bill in the past, because what this does is it makes it cheaper for U.S. companies to make products. So the argument that members will make is this will reduce the cost to the manufacturer of producing this item, and therefore it's more jobs in my district and it helps the economy overall.
That kind of turns the discussion slightly as we also bring up the conversation of earmarks. First off, explain to those who may not be fully aware what an earmark is.
That's actually a more complicated question than it seems. Until recently, the term hasn't really been defined. Earmarking was more of a practice or a procedure that members of Congress used literally dating back to the first Congress. So what members did was they inserted provisions into spending bills mainly, but also into other measures that directed federal agencies to provide money through established programs
mm-hmm.
for certain projects. And it was only until recently that the rules that the House and Senate operate under actually defined the term. And generally, so I'm paraphrasing
Understood.
It basically means when a member of the House or the Senate requests funding for a specific entity, and that funding gets to that entity outside of the traditional formula or competitive grant process.
So I'm looking at here at a page of a lot of different quotes that various people have said about earmarks. At this point, we're not using them anymore, correct?
Yes, correct.
Okay.
They're not actually banned, but the rules...
Which is what a lot of people will say.
Correct.
Earmarks are completely banned. We're not allowed to use these anymore.
Correct.
Okay.
There is a moratorium that the House and Senate have agreed to this year. So the rules of the House actually allow bills to contain earmarks, provided with the caveat
mm-hmm.
that there's a list of them and the folks who requested them are listed as well. So the rules don't prohibit them, but they're really trying to make the process more transparent.
Okay.
But what happened was, at the start of this Congress, so January of 2011, both the House and Senate said, you know what, we're going to have a moratorium on earmarks. And they essentially did this by having the leaders of various committees tell members of the House and Senate, we're not going to include earmarks in bills under our committee's jurisdiction.
And then the House Republicans actually went one step further when they put together the rules that their party was going to operate under for the current session of Congress. Mm-hmm. They said, members, you're not allowed to request earmarks this year. So Congress can earmark funding, but they're just choosing not to.
Here's a quote that I found from Michelle Bachmann. During my first term in Congress, I signed a pledge that I will take no more earmarks, and I've been faithful to that pledge. Well, now she really doesn't have a choice
right.
at this
yes.
point. So faithful really means nothing at this point with regard to that quote. The BGov Insight is entitled Tariff Reductions Caught Up in Earmark Ban. Her name is Melissa Avstray.
Yes.
Yeah, two
good
times
job.
In a row. Lauren, I got some questions for you.
Sure.
You know, and Melissa, feel free to pipe in here anytime. I know you're a guru in this area as well. The House is on recess. Senate's out next week,
right.
taking some time off, doing some district work. I'm doing the air quotes. when they return, June is what they're going to be really looking at this point.
Right. June will probably be a very busy month. And we're running out of time here to get the work done because with the election looming and an August break plus the political conventions, every week's going to be precious from here on out to actually get things done.
How are they going to kick off the appropriations fight and wrap that up, hopefully?
Well, June won't see the end of that.
No, I know it won't see the end, but at least we can get the ball rolling.
Right. You need to get the ball rolling. You have to start getting bills passed mm-hmm. in the two chambers so that you can start sitting down and working out the differences between them. Because as we know, with Republicans writing them primarily in the House and Democrats being the primary authors in the Senate, some of these bills are taking very different paths as they move through. So they've already done one in the House. It took two very long days to get through one of the appropriations bills.
Right.
And there's 11 more to go if they decide to do them all on the floor. So I would assume one or more would start coming up in June on the floor, and they'll take some time. And
so we're talking like mid-July.
No. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly not, I'm sure.
Some of the appropriators have already said their bill might not make it to the floor before conference, but they're going to spend some time on the spending bills.
How about farmland conservation? Talking about the farm bill, that's on deck now. What's happening next?
There's some discussion about doing that on the Senate floor in June. The Senate Agriculture Committee reported its bill out. The House Agriculture Committee is still developing its bill. But if they can find floor time in the Senate, which that's even more precious than House floor time, then they want to move that to the floor. But there's some fights ahead because it wants to restructure the way the farm programs have worked, which now there's direct payments that are made to farmers, and it would shift to more of a risk management system. And not everybody is happy with the
right.
approach the committee took.
Here's something that's very near and dear to a lot of people who are listening's hearts right now, talking student loans.
Right.
Student loans, July 1st, those interest rates could double.
Could double,
in
right.
a lot of cases. Where are we with that?
Well, there seems to be agreement among Republicans and Democrats that they should freeze the rates where they are now, prevent this doubling of rates from happening July 1. The question is how to pay for it. And the House and Senate so far have two different approaches. Reconciling that won't be easy because there's about a $6 billion cost to freezing these, and they don't want that to be uncovered. So if they can come to agreement on how to pay for it, I would expect to see something in June because, you know, no one wants those rates to go up.
Understood. Lauren, as usual, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. I'm sure you'll come back and keep us up to date.
If you'll have me.
Of course.
All right.
Of course. We are pretty much out of time here at Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio. Remember, you can learn more about Bloomberg Government's award-winning analysis, tools, and data at www.bgov.com. If you're a social media type, follow us on Twitter at BloombergGov. Thanks to Caitlin Weber and Ken Monahan, who studies U.S. trade remedies may harm U.S. companies and duties on Chinese solar panels may harm U.S. companies, the indirect impact of unfair trade cases. And we also thank you, Melissa. Thank you for stopping by. Her BGov Insight entitled Tariff Reductions Caught Up in Earmark Ban is also available at BGov.com. And, of course, thanks to you for listening. We'll plan on getting together again next Thursday, 11 a.m., let's say. We've got plenty more to say about the business impact of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., I'm Alan Scott.